That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire, both still quite emotional having actually seen each other on Friday, albeit it was in Brighton, so I couldn't wait to leave. It's actually easier to get a tattoo there now to get chips. What's going on in that town?
It's ink central, isn't it? It's absolutely amazing.
Well, yeah, you get an inflatable unicorn, you get a packet of chips and some candy floss. No, you cannot. It's questions day, Kieran, but there's one big news story to catch up on, of course, after congratulating Brentford and Chelsea. Big day in West London and all over Surrey for Chelsea fans. And hopefully by the end of this pod, which we've timed badly, we'll be able to say congratulations to Blackpool and Lincoln, the second half of which is on the way as we speak. People never talk about Blackpool and Lincoln, the playoff to get in the championship. They never say that's the second most expensive game in the world, do they, Kieran? They're always talking about the Premier League playoff, most expensive game in the world. No one seems to worry about this one.
Well, this one is still a game changer for both of these clubs, potentially, because you're going to go from a TV deal, which is worth about £1 to £1.5 million, to one which is worth £7 to £8 million. So you're multiplying by a factor of five. And of course, you're now just one step away from the Premier League and all of the excitement that brings. So, I've got affections for both clubs. Clearly, my history as an employer in Blackpool was whilst it was short lived, it was certainly an experience. And I've got to know the people at Lincoln extremely well because they're big fans of the podcast. And in terms of how to run a club, they're part of my 5-star team as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and Brentford fans would probably be happier getting promoted this year than last, because they'll be able to see their team in the Premier League this year. Anyway, that elusive news story that I mentioned way back before we started ad-libbing, which neither of us should do, it's the outcome of the National League vote of no confidence, Kieran.
Yes. The vote was defeated. Mm. The National League board have survived the vote of no confidence, and they went out and said the result the result is convincing.
I like convincing. I like convincing.
Yes. And I guess it is convincing in terms of votes, but the reason for this was that lines were very much split dependent upon which division you're in. Mm. So as far as the National League itself was concerned, where it is one club, one vote, there was almost unanimous support for the board. Once you dropped into National League North and South, the situation was reversed. So in terms of the way that the clubs effectively voted, it was 33 clubs in favour and 33 clubs against. Mm. But because the clubs in National League North and South only get 4 votes per division, it ended up as only 7 votes against the board. And if that was the case, you know, the first thing you do is you come out with something a little bit more conciliatory rather than the rather triumphalist. The result is convincing. Oh, fucking hell.
What? You haven't even got a hangover as an excuse.
Now, unlike the Baroness, no, I haven't.
Really?
Yes, we went out for a tapas meal last night, and the Baroness went for the wine flight. Well, and I don't even know what a wine flight is, Kevin. As well as a few straighteners beforehand, she's feeling a bit delicate.
Yeah, you don't need to know what the wine flight is, Kieran. You just strap yourself in for the wine flight. It doesn't matter where you land in the end. It's fine. Essentially, Kieran, this is neither convincing, convincing, or convincing. It's the result of a voting anomaly. I mean, it's a straightforward 50-50 split. And as you say, it doesn't suit them to be this triumphalist. What you should be looking for after a vote like this is clearly some clubs are upset. Clearly there are issues. Clearly there are communication problems. But instead, they're out there punching the air, aren't they?
Yes. It does say that the National League Board acknowledges the importance of working collectively with member clubs. Well, the trouble is that the league is split very significantly. There does appear to be some conflicts of interest. And I think one of the things which came through with our discussion with Andy Holt on the Thursday show was he said he felt very uncomfortable about individual clubs being able to effectively or having their executives voted onto the senior board because they get to know what's happening before the other clubs, which gives them a competitive advantage. And there is rampant self-interest in football, and I don't have an issue with that. We've all got an element of self-interest in all aspects of our lives, but whether this is for the greater good, I'm not so certain. So I think the ship is holed but not sunk would be my view as far as where we are with the National League at present.
But do you think, Kieran, this is one of those issues that come September, October, please God, and they're all back to 100% capacity, they're all getting match day income, they're all getting their broadcasting income again. It's one of those things that will be forgotten, and people say, well, it happened in unusual circumstances during the pandemic and now we're back on track, or do you think this is going to leave lasting resentments and attempts to get the constitution changed?
I don't think the constitution will be changed, because for that to take place, that the National League teams themselves would have to go to a vote, and they're not going to vote to dilute their degree of control and power. It is unlikely. As we have seen with Dominic Cummings, grudges can last a long time, and will spill out in some other way, shape, or form later on, unless you get people around the table, you listen, and you try to go forward and say, well, ultimately, what are we all looking for, and try to find some common ground.
Never mind. Dominic Cummings might be upset, but Boris Johnson got married in a Catholic cathedral yesterday, which is proof positive that my mum's not paying attention in heaven, because we haven't had we've had no thunderstorms, earthquakes, or anything like. I know producer Guy will be listening to this because we're right at the start of the podcast, and he gets 5 minutes in before he goes off, starts counting stuff, and comes back 5 minutes from the end. So we've discussed it. We're going to try and get some of our friends in the National League to come on and have a brief 5 minute chat about the outcome, and maybe get two people who voted on in different directions just to see what they think the future will be. Now let's take a deep breath, Kieran, because we're going in deep with these questions.
they're long ones today, aren't we? We've got essays.
They are, but they're funny enough. I always look to try and get Guy to sub them down beforehand, but he's got too many channels on his TV, I reckon. He hasn't got time to do that sort of thing. But sometimes, even with my literary skills, you just have to ask the whole question, because otherwise you don't get the full context for it. And the first one comes from Tom Morgan. And it's kind of it's something that's underpinned most pods that we do, Kieran, but it's never something that we've actually answered in detail this way. Tom Morgan is doing an A-level EPQ on the finances of football. Good luck with that. Could you explain, says Tom, the ways in which your nouveau riche teams like PSG, Chelsea and Man City are able to get round the FFP, Financial Fair Play regulations, whereas teams like my QPR are tangled in and ruined by it? I'm guessing, Tom, the simple answer is because of the size of those nouveau riches.
I think that is a contributory factor. Clearly, the wealthier the club, the smarter the lawyers that you can employ to put forward your case. And one of the things I've learned over the past couple of years is that having a brief who is well briefed and is persuasive and knowledgeable certainly is going to help your position. Having
hang on a second, Kieran. When did that happen? What? This is your. We're talking about Uncle Terry's brief, or your brief here?
No, I'm talking about sort of general football finance.
You just had me worried. Then I thought, God, I was worried about getting a subpoena or some kind of American style demand to come to court and give evidence.
My personal view is that Queen's Park Rangers got an excellent settlement. When they were charged, because they didn't have a points deduction, they did go up to the Premier League, and although the headlines was it was a £42 million settlement, when I went through the small print, and as you're fully aware, I like small print, and also the fact that the QPR defending team was headed by our very good friend Nick DeMarco, of whom I have the highest regard. Half of the settlement was effectively converting loans which could never be repaid into shares. So that cost them nothing. Yes, they had to pay the EFL's fees. Then they had to go and pay, I think it's sort of 13 or 14 million pounds, but effectively spread over 18 years. So it's not the same as having to put out a large amount of cash up front. And they did get the benefit of a year in the Premier League plus 4 years of parachute payments. So Queen's Park Rangers made an awful lot of money out of the year in which they breached financial fair play. So I don't think they were as hard done as Tom seems to believe. And then when we take a look at PSG, City and Chelsea, they all have been subject to sanctions by UEFA. Admittedly, not necessarily as significant as UEFA would have liked, but they've all been subject to large fines. We're talking millions upon millions of euros. They've had to put through salary caps. They've had the size of their squads reduced for years in which they were in the Champions League. And it certainly impacted upon the clubs in terms of the progress or lack of in that competition. So it comes down to having a good legal team and also having not breached the rules in the first place. I think the issue with Queen's Park Rangers was that the year in which they were subject to the FFP challenge, their wage bill was, I think it was over twice that of any other club in the Championship that season. And they certainly had a competitive advantage. Now, lots of people say that Manchester City and PSG and Chelsea have had competitive advantages as well. But all of those clubs that we have named have all been subject to various forms of penalties. Could the PSG and Manchester City owners afford the financial fines more easily than Queen's Park Rangers? Without doubt. But they should that be taken into consideration? You know, if you and I, or let's say that you and I and producer Guy, if we all go get caught doing 35 miles an hour in a 30 mile zone, should we be subject to different fines simply because we've got different levels of income?
But yeah, well, that's a good point. I'd be subject to a massive fine because I can't drive. So I really, if I was doing 35 miles an hour. And I think we should point out, Kieran, you do like small print in the same way that the Baroness likes a wine flight. Let's not judge either of you. Tom, good luck with your exams. I hope that helped. I suspect it didn't really. But the FFP is one of those things, Kieran. Whoever you support, you will think that your team has been hard done by it while everybody else is getting away with it, really. And that's partly because it's quite a difficult situation to decipher, really, isn't it? Anyway, Johnny Foster, that was a profound thing to say, wasn't it? It's quite a difficult thing to cope with, isn't it? Johnny Foster has one of those simple questions that I really like. One of those questions that you think, I really want to know the answer to this one. And he asks, does Johnny Foster, how is money transferred between clubs? is there an invoice sent for a player transfer, for example, with the seller's bank details on the bottom, which I quite like that idea, that it's like the invoice that we optimistically sent a guy once every 6 months. Also, how are fines paid and what happens if there are insufficient funds in the account? I mean, it's a good question. I can't imagine Man United getting a text like I do most mornings saying, please put insufficient funds by 2 p.m.
Well, yeah, this is an intriguing question from Johnny. When it comes to international transfers, historically, there have been a lot of problems. And the reason behind those problems is due to something what we refer to as training compensation. If a player is transferred under the age of 23, then the side which he originally played for when he was a kid and as part of his development is due some form of compensation. And what FIFA were finding was that an awful lot of that compensation was not being paid by the club that was buying the player. And it was proving to be an absolute pain in the backside, because if you are a small club in Poland and one of your players has ended up going to Real Madrid or Borussia Dortmund or Newcastle, wherever it's going to be, actually trying to get money out of these clubs is really hard. And it's similar in other lines of business. If you're a small supplier who is supplying a big grocery store, and I won't name names, they are complete pains in the arse to deal with. And when I used to do insolvency work way back when, you know, as you know, I was based in the Northwest for most of my life, and we used to end up doing quite a few administrations of the rag trade, you know, the clothes manufacturing.
Yeah.
And there is one very well-known clothing retailer, which used to be very famous for selling nearly all of its products, which were made in the UK, and they were an absolute nightmare to deal with in terms of, yes, it's great to get the contract from them, but trying to get money out of them once they deliver the goods. And, of course, cash flow is critical to business. We talk on this show about profit and so on. You know, profit schmoffit, it's cash flow, that cash is king in business. And similarly for these small football clubs. So, you know, I give FIFA a fair amount of stick, but to give them some credit, one thing which they have very recently done is that they've set up a clearinghouse. So where there are international transfers, what FIFA will do is they will say, well, this player is being transferred from clubs A to B. We've got the player's history in our books, because every time he's transferred, he gets logged into the system. And the money has to come to us. So the buying club pays the money to FIFA, who then distributes it to all of the relevant parties. So that actually works in theory particularly well. I have seen proposals to link this to things such as blockchain and uber nerdy types of stuff. When it comes to
Kieran, what currency is that paid in then?
Well, it will be paid normally in the currency of the selling club. So if Juventus are selling to a club in the Premier League, then as far as Juventus are concerned, yeah, they are expecting to be paid €80 million. Right. And they don't give a hoot. So it would normally be sorted in the currency of the selling club.
So would you get buying clubs then waiting a few days just for a more favourable exchange rate, for example?
Well, they wouldn't be party to. I mean, they could get a little bit more or less than they'd anticipated if there are movements in the exchange rate between the date of the transfer going through and the date that FIFA get round to making the distribution. But it shouldn't be significant unless you're dealing with a country with a very quickly devaluing currency. Because I remember I went to Peru in the late 80s, and we went into the I went to the Manu National Reserve to go and I was trying to find some giant river otters, and I went in with a load of Peruvian money into the Andes. not in the Andes, sorry, into this tributary of the Amazon. And I came out 6 days later, covered in bites, but I had seen the giant river otters, which I was absolutely delighted about. And the I think the I was about $500 or $600 worth or pounds worth of Peruvian currency. In the meantime, there had been a military coup in Peru, and all of my money was worthless.
I could only apologise to those of you playing FYP bingo today, because ain't none of you got giant river otters. That was every now and again I'll go in and Ali will say, "Did he mention?" I'll say, "Yeah, he mentioned that." Never giant river otters. Never. You're the only accountant I know who could blunder his way into a military coup whilst looking apparently for giant river otters in the middle of, in the middle of Peru. Things just happen around you, Kieran, don't they? It's amazing.
But seeing that mother otter with four cubs was it was a transcendental moment, baby.
I love otters because they look like cats in the water. I think otters right. are lovely. I also this is really by the by. Also get very cross with Wind in the Willows because they call their baby otter Portly. You can't label a kid like that. Anyway, in the unlikely event that there aren't insufficient funds in the account of a Premier League team to pay the giant... Sorry, carry on. I'll be back with you in a second, Kieran. I'll be fine.
Right, yeah. Well, I mean, if the buying club fails to make the payment in time, then it would have to go to a tribunal. And there are ombudsmen, and there is both within UEFA and FIFA, bodies which have to deal with this, and we'll be looking at one of those disputes a little bit later in this show, I think.
Hmm. Kieran, you're the multitasker in this relationship, so can you keep an eye on the Lincoln Blackpool score for us?
Rightio.
So it sounds quite exciting. Sounds like, well, I mean, obviously, by the time people listen to this, they'll be fully aware of the score, or they'll be going, "Oh, I'd forgotten that game was on."
Blackboard 2-1 up.
Are they? Oh, okay.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Mike Terry has a question about kits. As you know, questions about kits will always be asked, especially retro ones. That's retro kits, not retro questions. Older fans like me, says Mike, yearn for remakes of the great Adidas Admiral and Matchwinner shirts from seasons past. Although some clubs do this, but what is there preventing a team like Notts County, for example, from doing it? Is it manufacturers holding copyright, or is it such a niche market that a minimum order number is prohibitive?
Well, I think Mike's probably hit nail on head. So there is normally some demand for these kits. And if we take a look at some of the classic kits that I think he was referring to, we've seen the England 1974 and 78 World Cup kits. They always tend to be quite popular. What normally happens is that if you want to use the badge of the Football Association, then potentially you have to get a license. And I believe that there is now a company, and we're not on any commission from this, by the way, a company called Score Draw, which has gone into that market in quite a big way to try to sort of get some of the classic Umbro and Adidas kits going, because England have had some brilliant kits over the years, as have Scotland and of course, their individual clubs. The present manufacturers tend to be a little bit cautious about retro kits because, A, you've got to go and set up a new line in the factory for them. So, that's going to slow things down. And B, to a certain extent, you're in danger of cannibalizing your brand new product. So, yes, they will be prepared to do some, but there are issues in terms of who has the intellectual property in terms of both the badge and the design, although that can be worked around. But I think Mike also hit the nail on the head in the sense that, yes, it could be that a few blokes of advanced ages, shall we say, have a nostalgic and emotional relationship with a kit from a particular season. But will that actually be of any interest to people who are younger? But we are seeing a huge interest in some sort of classic kits. You know, the Netherlands kit of 1988 when they won the European Championships is an absolute classic. And I think the manufacturers are now starting to realise that and are sort of doing limited editions in the years of the World Cup and Euros to meet that demand.
Well, also for some of the older shirts, the manufacturers would have to find a lot of cotton. Yes. Somebody brought me a 76 Palace shirt. I don't know how they wore it. You can't get it wet. You'll never get it. It's just, and before people tweet in, by the way, when Kieran talks about the England World Cup kits of 74 or 78, he means the qualifying kits. We didn't actually play in the finals of those tournaments.
So yes, we did.
We are aware of those things, don't worry. Philip Story has the sort of question that you like, Kieran. It's straightforward, down the line, Yorkshire question. And Philip Story's question is this: what do you think of the Barnsley owners, especially the ones from overseas? They're presumed to be very wealthy, but we know nothing about them, says Philip.
Yes. The main guy, as far as Barnsley is concerned, appears to be a gentleman called Chien Lee, a very successful entrepreneur and a multiple club owner. So he's trying to go down the City Football Group route, with a view to exploiting the benefits of that. And I think we have sort of concluded that there are benefits in terms of having a sort of a global template in terms of player development. He certainly sniffed around a few other clubs before finally buying Barnsley, Hull, Middlesbrough, Brentford. I know at three that he was linked with. And he's linked up with Billy Beane, who is famous, of course, in baseball for the Moneyball system. Mm. And sort of these two guys together feel very much that their interest and enthusiasm for data analytics, again, it's something we have discussed on more than one occasion, is going to allow them to recruit and develop players to push things on. So, you know, Barnsley had a very good season considering their resources. And it was noticeable. Barnsley's accounts came out actually earlier this week. And as you can imagine, that got me excited. Mm. And that they certainly are investing more money in players with a view to recouping that from player sales. So, I think for me, that there's nothing necessarily to be worried about. I mean, Barnsley is now owned by BFC Investments Limited, which is based in Hong Kong, but that's not necessarily a good thing or a bad thing. It's just a thing. It is further evidence of the commoditization of football players. They are seen as widgets to buy and sell, and that's always made me feel slightly uncomfortable, but am I just being a bit naive in that respect?
No, you're being a human being, Kieran. Liam Blaney has a question which will be of interest to all Palace fans listening, because it seems to be how we do our business season upon season. Liam Blaney's question is there any legitimate financial reason why a club would leave doing their transfer business to the last moment, or is it just to give Sky something to talk about on deadline day? I quite like the idea that Sky are giving clubs backhanders to hold their transfer, but Jim White handing out brown paper bags full of cash on a motorway service station somewhere. But it's a question that, I mean, Steve Parrish, we asked him Steve Parrish's question once on a pod, and he said it's nothing to do with finances. It's more to do with the nature of transfers, in that quite often a club is looking to buy their fourth or fifth choice on the last day of the transfer season, because their first, second and third choices have fallen through. But it seems to be that there's only one or two clubs doing business like that. So you can't help wondering whether there is, as Liam says, a legitimate financial reason why some clubs do seem to do all their business on the last day of the window.
Well, if you saw my mind map in front of me, it says first, second, third and fourth choice. We know each other too well, Kevin, in regards to this. But I think there are some ancillary issues as well. The later you leave it in the transfer window, the less you have to pay in wages. Because remember, once you've signed the player, he's your employee from that date. So if you can defer the signing, then that could save you four, six, 8 weeks of wages. That is a considerable sum of money, especially in the Premier League. What we also have is a game of who blinks first as far as transfer negotiations are concerned. A club's put in a bid, it's been rejected, and now there's an element of gunboat diplomacy taking place here, in the sense that is there a way of extracting, a second or third or a fourth bid for a player that you really want? Keep saying no, especially if you don't need to sell. And then there's the domino effect, in the sense that, yes, finally you do sell a player at 6 p.m. on transfer deadline day, which means that you've now got a hole in your squad. So therefore, you've got 3 or 4 hours in which to fill that hole yourself. So you get this sort of this whirligig taking place in the final few hours, as it's a money go round. From a financial perspective. So there are financial considerations, but I think Steve Parrish, who's clearly been involved in this thing and the coalface far more than we have, is absolutely right that you're not just looking to sign a player, you're looking to sign a player from a choice of four, and you've got your preference. And if that preference goes elsewhere, then you've got to turn your attention and the sands of time are slowly going down.
Yeah, or you could be the sort of club that tries to attract your first choice before the end of the season, rather than having to rely on the fifth choice. But let's not turn this into a Palace pod. Roughly this time last year, Kieran, I remember distinctly saying that I hoped we wouldn't still be talking about this story 365 days later. Yet here we are, unfortunately, and David Manley has asked us the question by pointing out it's now more than 2 years since the tragic death of Emiliano Sala and the pilot of the plane he was flying in. David says, I believe Cardiff were ordered by FIFA to pay Nantes what was owed, but I'm not sure if that's happened yet. So how is the saga affecting both clubs financially? And if Cardiff haven't paid, what sort of punishment could FIFA enforce on a club side?
Right.
excuse me.
Emiliano Sala, and you're absolutely right. People don't talk about the pilot, and then that should be remembered. But both of these young men had families and loved ones, and they've been sadly lost. The nature of the transfer was that Cardiff were due to pay a €6 million deposit, €5 million a year later, and €5 million in a further 12 months, plus a potential €1 million should. Cardiff City avoided relegation. So if you go onto the FIFA website, there's about a 20-page document when FIFA did investigate this. And the selling club went to FIFA and said, we've not been paid the deposit. And FIFA looked at the documentation and they said, well, as far as we are concerned, Emiliano Sala was a Cardiff City football player, and you have failed to pay that initial deposit. So we are going to charge you. You've got to pay immediately €6 million plus interest. And then FIFA said, and when this ruling went through, the second installment at that point in time was not due. So they said, we cannot force Cardiff to pay the second and third installments, because there is no due date. So at present, we don't know whether Cardiff City have made the second or third instalments, but they certainly should have made the first instalment by the looks of this, unless there was an appeal. And I've seen nothing on the FIFA website to that effect, but sometimes these things, of course, take place behind closed doors. Mm. As we've said on more than one occasion, neither party has come out of this with any credit. I appreciate we're operating in a world of money, but from the sake of humanity, for heaven's sake, some of the rhetoric coming out from the two football clubs and Emiliano Sala's agent was just very distasteful indeed. Yeah. This is a human being. It is not a piece of meat. It is not a car. It is not a computer. Remember that.
This episode of The Price of Football is brought to you by the AI-powered workspace Notion.
We are living in an era of information overload, and we have more knowledge than ever before. But what do we do with it all? If you're in Notion, you put that knowledge to work.
It's a workspace designed not just for making progress, but getting inspired. And all I can say on a personal level, as for somebody whose life is quite chaotic, and I'm writing pieces for government and newspapers and media content, I've got my university commitments and I'm supposed to be writing a book, I use Notion all the time because it brings order into chaos.
Well, if you need order brought to your chaos, you can try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/priceoffootball. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/priceoffootball, and start turning your ideas into action. That's notion.com/priceoffootball.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Well, yeah, please God, let us not be talking about it this time next year as well. Paul Doddymead asks this question. Before Christmas, says Paul, Fenway put forward a plan to restructure the Premier League to increase their revenues, Project Restart. This was rejected. They were then one of the driving forces of the Super League. Their strategy to reform the industry for their own aggrandisement seems to have failed. And there appears to be little synergy with baseball anymore. Do you think pressure will now grow on Fenway from private equity, institutional investors, analysts, etc., to divest their interest in Liverpool? It's a question that a lot of Liverpool fans would love to know the answer to.
Yeah, it's an intriguing one. FSG have done a lot for Liverpool. Certainly, we've had the expansion of the ground. Yeah. Trophies have been delivered, Champions League. And the Premier League. So those are both positives. It's quite clear from comments from John Henry before Project Big Picture was leaked that he wanted some form of concentration of power, control and wealth in the hands of a few people, which, you know, we're all entitled to our beliefs. FSG acquired Liverpool for £300 million. They could sell Liverpool today, in my view, for at least $2 billion. They could take that. They could make a very tidy profit, should they so desire. I think the issue now is, given that Super League is at best can be described as floundering. Remember, it's still not dead. We've still got Barcelona, Real Madrid, and Juventus doing a chemical alley. There's no problem here. Routine. So I think the general sentiment is that if something is going to take place, and if we're still doing this nonsense in 5 or 10 years, we could be having a similar conversation to Super League. I don't think it's going to occur in a hurry. So therefore, are Liverpool at maximum value from FSG's point of view? Because there was no doubt that if Super League had taken place, then the concentration of wealth in the hands of relatively few clubs would have increased the value of Liverpool as a product, as an investment. Now that Super League isn't going to take place and they can't go take control of the domestic game under Project Big Picture, which was their other aim, where is the growth from a financial perspective as far as Liverpool is concerned? If we have reached peak or plateau, then there's a case for saying, well, you know, perhaps we ought to be looking at, is this the best use of our money, especially if we could sell the club for £2 billion. You know, we've got effectively a 600-700% return on our investment. That's pretty damn good. Mm. And we'll focus more on US franchise sports, for whom the culture is something with which we are more familiar.
And what about Paul Dodimid, sort of the example of the outside influences? Are there outside influences that would encourage them to offload?
Yes, I mean, if private equity companies are just looking for a financial return,
right?
So they will say to FSG, if there are outside investors, we rely on you to look after a portfolio of investments on our behalf. If you don't think you can extract any more money from Liverpool Football Club, what the hell are you doing carrying it on, right, your books? Why not sell them and buy something which has got more opportunities for growth?
If Super League had been nodded through and we were planning for it now, what would Liverpool be worth now?
I think you could add 50% onto the value, because Liverpool is a fantastic brand. The big elephant in the room, which I always felt got under discussed, was that when you went through the small print of both Super League and Project Big Picture, it was the ability of the clubs to sell the TV rights direct to fans.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's say that Liverpool have got, you know, Manchester United claim to have 1.1 billion fans. Now, I take that with a pinch of salt. Let's say that Liverpool have got 300 million fans, and they sell 10%. To 10% of their fan base, and they get them to stump up £10 for an individual match. That's £300 million per match. Liverpool's total revenue last year was around about £470 million.
Wow.
So therefore, they could make more money from two TV matches than they get in a full season.
Wow.
And that was what was driving both Big Picture and Super League, but it seemed to fly under the radar.
Mm. If they are worth £2 billion now, as you say, who out there has got that sort of money at the moment? I mean, could anybody put that sort of money? Are there hundreds of equity companies that could find that? Or are we talking about...
Oh, there are. It's not an issue. We saw Amazon have just bought a big movie studio during the week. I think, you know, we fall into this trap of thinking that the football industry is a big industry. It's not, you know, and I go back to that nerd point I brought out last week, that the total wages of the Premier League since it started, plus the total transfer fees paid, is less than 1 year's worth of income for Bet365. Mm. Football is a small industry with a big social footprint in terms of its media footprint.
Mm. Jamie McAllister has this question. Apart from it making logical sense, would it have made financial sense to scrap the League Cup, Carabao Cup, at the beginning of the season, factoring in that there are no spectators and the first months of the season may have been a little less hectic?
I think possibly not, because... Yeah, well, Captain Hindsight, who appears to be a new British character following revelations in the Commons this week. With Captain Hindsight, we might take that view that perhaps it should have been scrapped. But if we go back to August, you know, we were thinking about crowds of 2,000. We were having these pilot schemes.
That's
I think
true.
Everybody thought, oh, there's not going to be a second wave, and we would start to ramp up in terms of attendances. The thing about the Carabao Cup, which again doesn't get a lot of attention, is that it is the EFL's competition. Now, the EFL TV deal with Sky is worth £119 million a year. Depending upon who you talk to, somewhere between one third and two thirds of that money is actually down to the Carabao Cup. And you might be saying, well, hold on. Yeah, that seems a bit odd. But the Carabao Cup final was, Manchester City won it. There's some big matches taking place between Premier League clubs. If you, I love the Championship and League One and League Two, and before you say it, you know, as a Brighton fan, I don't have much choice in not loving them, given our history. But if we take a look at the Championship, if it's Reading versus Middlesbrough, who's going to be watching it? If it's, you know, if it's Barnsley versus Bournemouth,
yeah,
you know, Sky's got the TV deal, but Sky will be saying, well, actually, yeah, thanks very much, guys. There's nobody actually watching.
Yeah.
So if you've then got the Carabao Cup, and there always tend to be a few cracking fixtures involving the big six, and we're not denying that. Yeah, they are drivers. This is why I think the EFL probably did the right thing in not scrapping that, because in a year in which their clubs were suffering huge financial difficulties, to say that we're going to have to forego somewhere between a third and two-thirds of our TV deal on top of that would have made what has been a fairly challenging year far worse. So, the collateral is that players get fatigued, increased injuries, but, you know, as I think we've established already during the show, football players are just commodities. Yeah, they're not human beings.
Mm. Anybody who just started listening to the pod at that point, Kieran is not saying footballers are commodities. That was in context, just in case you think this is a really cruel accountant there. I've introduced you, Gary. I'll tell you who watches the Carabao Cup. That's the first round. I always watch the first round of the Carabao Cup because you were still excited that football was back.
Yes.
Basically, it was like sometimes it was a week before the season even started. That was great. Thank you for that question, Jamie. It's acted as a sort of sorbet between the Liverpool course and the Man United course, which is coming up. We have a question from Kieran Walsh. And Kieran says, bearing in mind the Glazer family MO has been switching borrowing to cheaper loans since their takeover of Manchester United, I'm surprised they haven't availed themselves of the Bank of England COVID corporate financing facility, which is something we've talked about a lot recently. Would it have anything to do with conditions restricting senior executives' pay? Likewise, would it make it harder for dividends and consultation fees to be paid if the club underperformed financially?
Yeah, it's a valid point as far as Kieran is concerned. Again, if you go to the Bank of England CCFF loan page, which is very thorough and very well organised, dive into the small print, and it says, first of all, these loans are only available to private companies. Now, Manchester United is a public limited company. Its shares are traded on a stock market. So that's one reason why you can't have it. And secondly, the loans are not available to any institution which is funded via a leveraged buyout, i.e. you effectively take out a mortgage to buy the company.
Right, okay.
Now, Manchester United would therefore fail that particular category, as would Burnley, in my opinion, as well.
Yeah.
The other conditions, material UK material contribution to the UK economy, absolutely. Yeah, Manchester United, knock that one out of the park. Does it have a good credit rating? Well, the very fact that Manchester United can now borrow money at 2.25% to 3.75% to me suggests that they do have a good credit rating. So they satisfy a couple of the conditions, but not the others. In terms of the issue of executive pay, I think this would be a concern for the Bank of England because, as we've established, Manchester United pay dividends of around about £22 million a year, whether they make a profit or whether they make a loss, and a significant proportion of that money goes to the Glazer family. I think there could have been some potential pushback from the Bank of England in respect of that as well.
Mm. You know that diving straight into the small print thing you're always encouraging me to do? Do you ever look at the big print on the way? I worry you might miss something, Kieran, by going straight for the small print. It might be something glaringly obvious. Just need that reassurance. The penultimate question comes from Matt Houghton. Matt Houghton supports a club that you're always very supportive of yourself, Kieran. He's a Tranmere fan. And Matt's question is, how much money does my club Tranmere make by allowing Liverpool FC women's team to play their home matches at Prenton Park? Is it financially rewarding enough to have the extra burden put on the pitch?
Right. I went into Tranmere's accounts, and yeah, 5 stars for them. Very thorough. Mark Palios has a very good summary of the state of the finances, I was fortunate enough to listen to a Mark Palios masterclass to our MBA students recently. He is a very, very knowledgeable guy all around. Tranmere in their 2020 account said it cost them around about £50,000 to do extra work in terms of relaying the pitch and improving the pitch. It was a bit of a bog. So did the women's football contribute to that? Well, a little bit, I think, but you know, in my view, I don't think that would be hugely significant. I then went into the LFC women's football team's accounts and I went into the small print, it did say that the team spent a total of £102,000 in terms of rental paid. Now, whether that was just to Tranmere or whether it included some other facilities as well, it wasn't laid out. So it looks as if they paid £102,000, I think Tranmere would have had some financial benefit from hosting those matches. And remember, on top of the rental paid by LFC, presumably Tranmere would have had the sort of the catering rights and the sale of other things on match days, which would have further boosted their revenues. So on balance, I would say that Tranmere Rovers are better off financially from hosting Liverpool's matches at their own facilities. I'm sure in due course, I presume this will. If I'm honest, I think Liverpool women's team would have to return to the top tier of Women's Super League. That there will be some matches taking place at Anfield. I'm about to say Aintree there.
To be fair, the way Liverpool have treated their women's team, they could be playing at Aintree. As further proof that we've been married too long, Kieran, I've written down catering rights question mark. So essentially, for that money that Liverpool FC women's team pay to Tranmere, the only revenue they're getting then is the gate income from fans who turn up to watch the game. Everything else, it seems, is going to Tranmere.
I would imagine so. I mean, presumably there will be some merchandise. Yeah, there'll be a pop-up merchandise stall at the match, and that money would go to Liverpool. But I think sort of the core catering revenues would just be kept in-house by Tranmere. Otherwise, I think the complications of Liverpool having to bring in their own food and drink for an individual match and then ship them out again, it's just not worth the aggravation in terms of the margins given the attendances at these matches.
And that seems like a decent deal for Tranmere, because I mean I'm not sure how you quantify or put a value on the wear and tear on a pitch, but you would imagine it wouldn't take much repair after an extra game, extra 10 games a season. So that seems like a decent deal. Blackpool, Lincoln, Kieran, any update?
Blackpool 2, Lincoln City 1 full-time. Congratulations to Blackpool. Given what they have been through in terms of their ownership, I'm absolutely delighted for them. Commiserations to Lincoln. They've made fantastic progress in recent years.
Yeah, and Blackpool fans are a model example with their Not a Penny More campaign on how you
absolutely brilliant. Yeah.
How you can take someone down if they're messing with your club. Now, our final question, Kieran. I suspect maybe from Guy under an assumed name, because we don't often get a question that defends these particular people. But Jason Williams is the person who asked it, and he quite rightly, or wrongly, we'll see what happens when you've heard the question, leaps to the defence of some people that get some stick on this pod. So Jason says, why are property developers vilified on the price of football? I'm not one myself, just curious, which I believe used to be your catchphrase, Kieran. But Jason says, often Kieran will do some background research on someone, find they have a history in a development company, and alarm bells will start ringing. If someone wants to invest in a club to improve and make profit, is that such a bad thing? Surely any investment is good. Steve Morgan, who purchased Wolves in 2004, made no secret being a property developer or a Liverpool fan, but he built a new stand, invested money, got promotion, and left the club in a better position than he found it. Now, I think I know the answer to this, Kieran. I'm guessing it's because you've always said, you know, if property developers are buying a club, it's sometimes because the deal comes with a nice, juicy bit of inner city real estate tacked on. But I'll be interested to hear how you deal with Jason Williams' question. And it is a fair enough question. There's no reason why we should vilify them more than any other wrong'un who takes over clubs and drives them into the ground.
Yeah, I've not heard that first phrase you muttered since my days at the Pink Coconut. That is a long, long time ago. I've changed. I'll say no more than that.
Well, that's what I say to accountants, Kieran. I'm not one myself. I'm just curious. just one little spreadsheet, and let's see how I take it. It'll be fine. Can I point out how happy you were, by the way? I think our listeners know us well enough to know this, that Ali was production manager of the show that I directed in Brighton, and Kieran couldn't have been happier. I could not have seen a man smile more when we were sat in the lovely outdoor bar afterwards, basking in the fact that we were in actual human company after watching a show with actual people, when Ali asked if Kieran could give us some spreadsheet advice.
I'm looking forward to playing with that.
A new project that she's doing that needs a spreadsheet. Kieran was in heaven. We had words on the journey home, Kieran. You'll understand.
absolutely.
But anyway, so Jason Williams, and he's quite right. We do constantly say that alarm bells. I mean, there's certain phrases, you know, bought for a pound, property developers. These are phrases that do set the alarm bells ringing. Jason's quite right.
Yeah, there are good and bad property developers, just as there are good and bad people in all lines of profession. I think the issue that we have is that for most property developers, they see an exit route from a football club. The reason why property developers historically have been attracted to football clubs is that clubs have been there for a long, long time. And we've said on more than one occasion, football started as a working class sport where guys were coming out of factories, the pubs were closed on a Saturday afternoon, and it was an alternative place for them to go. And the wives were absolutely, you know, the wives didn't want them in the houses. So, you know, they'd send them off to the football. So therefore, we're looking at something which is central, which is, you know, from a property development point of view, desirable. They tend to be quite close to stations a lot of the time, so really good transport links. And if you can take a football ground and you can convert it into retail or residential, then you potentially are looking at rentals coming in 365 days a year. They're being utilized all the time. Football grounds are football is a really dumb industry. You're open 20 to 30 times a year. The rest of the time, you know, what's Selhurst doing? What's the Amex doing? What's Anfield doing? Mm. It's just sitting there. And yes, it's pretty, and yes, it's a testament to the history and the heritage of the local culture, and that's the reason why we all love it. From a financial point of view, it's just wasted space. It's wasted time. So property developers see that potential. Now, as far as Steve Morgan and Wolves is concerned, he did leave it in a better. He still left it in. It was 14th in the Championship when Fosun took over.
Mm.
So, you know, and Wolves had been down to League One. They'd been up and down, but Wolverhampton Wanderers. If you were to say, if I was often asked this question of people, where do you think your natural position in the football hierarchy is? And, you know, for a club like Wolves, I'd probably say lower half of the Premier League, top six of the Championship. Yeah, they're that type of club. So Steve Morgan did the deal. Yeah, Steve Morgan didn't come out of this penniless either. If we take a look at other clubs, and I've been looking at some issues recently, Wealdstone, Berkhamsted, if we go back to some of the issues that Crystal Palace have had in terms of, you know, people messing around with the property. If you look at what happened to West Ham and the Bowling, the West Ham owners sold it effectively to property developers for 40 million quid, who immediately sold it on to somebody else for 60. Yeah, a lot of money to be made. If I look at my club, Brighton, we sold the Goldstone ground in 1996 for £9 million it was immediately sold on for 27. So the reason why you don't feel comfortable about praising property developers is because they are looking to flip something. And if that also involves moving the football club and everything that you hold close to your heart. You and I, we both said it, that moving from one ground to another, you don't want it to happen. It might be a bit of a dump at times, but it's our dump. And that dump, which we have as part of our lives, has got 50 years of shared experiences and memories. And that's what you don't want to give up. Property developers, they're not interested in that. If I can shift this club's ground to an out-of-town site, and use this for retail or residential and make a lot of profit, then so be it. And the memories and the history and the heritage, that's somebody else's problem.
There are still issues at Sellers Park now with building the new stand because of leasehold, freehold, ownership issues dating back to 1990. So as you say, these are things. It occurred to me, Kieran, and I don't know if we can do this impromptu, that we did promise Sutton fans we'd mention the economic implications of their promotion today. I'm happy to wait till our next pod to do that, Kieran, or can we do that?
No, I can very quickly summarise it.
Let's do that. We did promise certain fans.
Yep. As far as the movement from the National League to the EFL is concerned, Sutton will now be in receipt of what's referred to as solidarity payments. They'll get a share of the Premier League TV deal. They'll get a share of the £119 million a year EFL deal as well. So that will benefit them by a seven-figure sum. So the overall benefit is a good £1 million. Good luck to them. And it's always great to see a new club coming into the football pyramid, because it is part of the romance for all fans. And everybody, I think, who are neutrals will be keeping an extra eye on their progress this season, just as we have done in respect of Harrogate and Barrow. And it's such a shame for the fans of both of those clubs who have come into the EFL and haven't been able to see their teams play in the professional echelons of English football.
But Sutton do have a Harrogate type situation as well, though, because they're going to have to rip up their 4G pitch, aren't they?
And that's their biggest asset. If I did take a look at their balance sheet and went into the supporting notes, and it does appear to be their most valuable asset. So that is a shame. I think there has been a debate. Harrogate had to do this 12 months ago. Is there a case for 3G in professional football? The view of club owners, the view of managers, and I think players is that they'd rather not have it. We do have it in Scotland as far as the Premiership, and I think it's fair to say that the perception there is mixed. It's a revenue earner for those clubs that have it. You talk to the likes of Steven Gerrard, and he's not happy with what he perceives as a potential for injury there. I once played on Oldham's pitch when they had a plastic pitch, and it was, I appreciate this was many years ago. It was horrible, absolutely horrible.
What position did you play, Kieran?
I played on the left wing, which is quite appropriate, really. We had a match against Oldham Supporters Club, which took place. It kicked off at 12:30, and Brighton were playing at Oldham at 3:00. So, we were the warm up act. I scored in the last minute at the Oldham end. Ran 90 yards to celebrate in front of the Brighton fans, not realizing that the referee had blown up for offside.
That's very funny. Just by way of a taster for our next pod, Kieran, one of our big news stories involves Scotland and Celtic and Rangers B team. So we will bring you more on that. And then, of course, our pod after that will be our next questions one. If you have any questions whatsoever on any aspect of football finance, and it's questions@priceoffootball.com. And in the meantime, I know 99.9% of you will be enjoying this stupid sunshine, so I hope you carry on having a lovely warm time. I shall leave you in the capable hands of Kieran McGuire to say goodbye.
Well, once again, folks, thank you so much for your support and your feedback. And it does genuinely amuse us when we see some of the comments. You hold us to an account in a way which other audiences don't. And that's great. That's absolutely great. If you enjoy the show, if you can click on that purple icon button for Apple Podcasts or Spotify and give us a 5-star review, it helps Producer Guy in terms of where we are in the tables. And it helps us to book the guests as well. So other than that, enjoy this wonderful weather we've had after a long, long wait, and look after yourselves.
Yeah, and just quickly, Kieran, in terms of listener feedback, can we 100% ascertain that giant river otters was not a euphemism?
Absolutely.
This was generally giant otters in a river.
Yes. Yeah. You've got the Manu National Reserve in Peru. You'll find it there.
Yeah. Chris Packham will now say all otters are in the river. So, and I'll say no, apart from the ones that are in the sea. Chris Packham and I don't get on, Kieran. I'll tell you that story next pod. Nice to see you. Bye, everybody.
Bye. The price of football.
Price of football.